make sure to give my dad a 5-star review.
Make sure to like and subscribe to his YouTube. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the show.
Welcome back to Heavenly Homeland, a 5-part audio documentary from the Faithful Politics podcast that looks at the impact of Christian nationalism in America. I'm your host, Will Wright.
Well, here at home, a local church helping out one of their members by building her a home.
A Santa Maria church is helping people who need basic necessities.
And among the many ministries they serve, churches are one of the main sources of help for migrants coming to the U.S. seeking asylum.
A group of faith leaders recently took extraordinary steps to address systemic racism.
Well, black churches are teaming up with health officials to get shots to underserved communities.
Then people in Monroe County now have access to a warming center amid frigid weather. A church in Forsyth opening its doors to give people a break from the cold.
11 tonight, a church group in Gaston County fighting to protect the homeless. Faith, Hope, and Love Community Enrichment Ministry says caring for the most vulnerable is what they're all about.
In this final episode, we turn the lens to a different side of Christianity in America, one that admittedly hasn't been portrayed very well in the context of our previous episodes. It's a side where faith intertwines with a deep respect for pluralism, where the teachings of Jesus inspire actions of love and inclusivity rather than division, and one where individuals are strengthened by their faith to do the impossible. You see, this episode is very special to me, because I didn't want to create a narrative that just totally dumps on Christians and the Bible, as there are millions of Jesus-loving believers out there that I feel exemplify what it means to be a real Christian and are doing the hard work of living their lives out in a way that is representative of the faith they belong to. And I don't know about you, but I've spoken to a number of friends, believers, and non-believers alike who have understandably very negative views about Christianity, based on what they see coming from those who espouse Christian nationalist ideology. And if I'm being honest, I can't necessarily blame them for the views and opinions they hold. So in this episode, I'm going to try to dispel the myth that all Christians are just one insurrection away from being a Christian nationalist. And we'll start with a story of grace and forgiveness at the least likely place you'd expect to find it, a courtroom.
Today is June 19th, 2015, Charleston County Bond Court. I'm Judge James Gosnell, the Chief Magistrate of Charleston County. This is the case of State versus Dylan Roof.
On the evening of June 17th, 2015, a young man entered the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. He was greeted with a warm welcome as he joined a Bible study group already in progress.
Mr. Roof is charged with 9 counts of murder and 1 count of possession of a weapon during the commission of a violent crime.
The attendees, unaware of his true intentions, embrace this stranger into their prayer circle. Even as a white supremacist, he sat there among several black worshipers, discussing the Bible and praying with those he would soon try to murder.
Ladies and gentlemen, before I get into the hearing, I'd like to make a statement, please. Charleston is a very strong community. We have big hearts. We're a very loving community.
The congregants, embodying Christian love, had no inkling of the darkness in the heart of the man amongst them. In the aftermath of such a heinous act, anger and a yearning for revenge are natural responses. The survivors on that night face an unimaginable ordeal.
Nobody would have ever thrown them into the whirlwind of events that they have been thrown into.
But in the Christian faith, as I understand it, we're urged to rise above these instinctual reactions. We're taught to forego revenge and retribution and forgive those who have hurt us.
Scarlett Wilson, the solicitor, and Ashley Pennington will have done the best job that they can do. They're some of the finest. Our law enforcement are the finest in this state, and they will do their job honorably. I trust they will. With that being said, we will move forward today with this hearing.
C.S. Lewis poignantly said, "Forgiveness is a beautiful idea until we have to practice it." Well, this profound truth came to life in the courtroom during the shooter's bond hearing.
Before we go into the bond process, I would like to ask, are there any members, or is there a representative of any of the family that would be here that wish to make a statement before this court, before I post or set the bond?
Confronted on the screen by those he tried to murder, the shooter was met not with hatred, but with a display of genuine Christian forgiveness. In a moving display of the Christian faith I came to personally know almost 2 decades ago.
I forgive you. It took something very precious for me. I would never talk to her ever again. I would never be able to hold her again. But I forgive you. And have mercy on your soul. You hurt me. You hurt a lot of people. But God forgive you. And I forgive you.
I forgive you, and my family forgive you. But we would like you to take this opportunity to repent. Repent. Confess. Give your life to the one who matters the most, Christ, so that he can change it, can change your ways no matter what happened to you, and you'll be okay. Do that, and you'll be better off than what you are right now.
We welcome you Wednesday night in our Bible study with open arms. You have killed some of the most faithless people that I know. Every fiber in my body hurts. And I'll never be the same. Tawanza Sanders is my son, but Tawanza was my hero. Tawanza was my hero. But as we say in a Bible study, we enjoyed you, but may God have mercy on you.
Despite the fact that the jury delivered a death sentence to the young man, don't let this outcome overshadow the remarkable bravery and resilience shown by the survivors. This story is less about the murderer and more about the victims. In the Christian faith, as exemplified in the teachings of Jesus, there's a call to stand apart from the worldly norms. When our leader is persecuted or attacked, we don't take up arms and storm the Capitol, but rather, we take a page out of the Bible and let it speak to our actions. Take, for example, the events in the Garden of Gethsemane before the crucifixion of Jesus. For those unfamiliar, the story goes something like this. Not long before Jesus and Barabbas stood before Pontius Pilate, as we heard in episode 4, temple guards came to arrest Jesus. However, Peter, one of his disciples, did what he thought he should do and impulsively cut off one of the guard's ear in defense of his revered leader. From a secular viewpoint, Peter's reaction might appear justified as an act of self-defense and loyalty. Yet Jesus reprimanded Peter, highlighting the repercussions of resorting to violence. Jesus conveyed that his path wasn't about violence. I mean, ostensibly he had the means to summon greater power, but chose not to. Rather, Jesus' response was to heal the injured guard, an act reflecting the ethos of God's kingdom. A kingdom that's not sustained by force, but by a compassionate love that extends even to his adversaries. The survivors of the AME church shooting embodied a similar Jesus mindset in the courtroom. They confronted the person responsible for their grief with forgiveness, exemplifying the essence of Christian love. To explore this theme further, we had a chance to speak with Shane Claiborne, a renowned speaker, activist, and author. His book, Executing Grace, How the Death Penalty Killed Jesus and Why It's Killing Us, offers profound insights into understanding grace and the Christian faith.
Wow. Well, one of the places I would start with, at least from my own perspective and my own experience, is that some things we only can have with the help of the Spirit of the living God, right? And so I think the power to forgive that Jesus displays on the cross, right? Even as people are killing him, he's saying, Father, forgive them for they don't know what they're doing. I find that, I'm not saying Christians are the only people that can forgive or show mercy, but I do think that, at least for me, part of what I have encountered from the courageous folks at Emmanuel AME is that faith, right? I mean, they were worshiping Jesus when he did this. They invited him in to their prayer meeting to be with them, right? And one of those people that has become a dear, dear friend and hero of mine is Reverend Sharon Risher. Her mother was killed in that shooting. Her two cousins were killed in that shooting. Her childhood friend was killed in that shooting. And when she talks about forgiveness, it is not this shallow, well, you just forgive and forget. You know, in fact, it's just the opposite. She says, you forgive and you remember because the scars are still there. And forgiveness is something we do with the help of the living God, you know. And she says, like, when I look at Dylan Roof, I don't see a man that needs the electric chair. I see a man that needs Jesus. And that's what fueled them, right, is this belief that even someone with a heart as hardened and as racist as Dylan Roof can be made new by the grace of God, right? And that doesn't mean that the scars aren't there, the pain isn't there. And this is also why I'm not a single issue person, right? Part of how I've gotten to know Sharon Risher is that we've talked about the death penalty, but we've also talked about gun violence and access to guns. And so I think these issues of life are all interrelated. And what we need to be having a conversation about is, what does it really mean to have that kind of consistent ethic of life?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey there, Josh Bertram here, faithful host of the Faithful Politics Podcast. I want to let you know about a compelling new spinoff, the Faith Roundtable, where I'll be interviewing top faith leaders, theologians, and scholars to unpack the pressing issues that are shaping the church in America today. We'll dive into topics like faith in public life, social justice, and how we can engage our communities more effectively. Make sure you don't miss any of our enlightening conversations by subscribing to it on our YouTube channel. Join me at the Faith Roundtable, where deep discussion meets thoughtful insight.
The demographics of Christians in the United States is vast, marked by a diverse array of beliefs, interpretations, and for better or for worse, political views. This diversity has been a core aspect of Christianity since its very beginnings, from Gentiles to women, and from the destitute to the unclean. The Christian faith has always been as diverse as it is old, and in our exploration of Christian nationalism, you might easily be led to believe that all Christians are cut from the same cloth. But that couldn't be farther from the truth. Take our podcast, Faithful Politics, for example, hosted by two Christians. We're separated by politics, but we're united by faith. With me being a progressive, cisgendered person of color, and my white conservative co-host, Pastor Josh Bertram, being...
Hey, Will.
Oh, hey, Josh. Wait, have you been there the whole time?
Yeah, I was waiting for you to say the trigger word white conservative co-host before I interjected, and lo and behold, there you did it.
Well, okay. So, yeah, number one, I don't recall us establishing a trigger word,
And
you always had to have a trigger word, Will.
how have you been able to just hold your tongue this entire time? I mean, I've said some pretty wild things about Christians in the Bible in that Trump episode. Oh boy, you know.
Yes.
Anyways, I'm happy you're finally unmuzzled, unchained, if you will.
Yes. Because
I've been trying to actually find ways to articulate why not all Christians are Christian nationalists and how folks can, I don't know, maybe better understand how to tell the difference.
Well, that's a great question, Will. And honestly, it's a tough question. But I think one of the best ways that we can tell the difference between someone who maybe is a nominal follower of Christ and someone who is taking the teachings of Christ seriously is by the way they love. As followers of Christ, it's pretty simple. We're supposed to do the kinds of things that Jesus asks us to do. For instance, Jesus says that we should love our enemies. He said that one in Matthew 5:44. He also said to do good to those who hate you. That one was in Luke 6:27. Love seems to be the greatest catalyst, motivator, and end goal of Christ's ministry. It was love that compelled God to become man in Christ in the first place. It was love that drove Jesus into the wilderness to be tested for 40 days without food or water. It was love that drove the demons out from the bodies of the oppressed and possessed. It was love that brought Jesus into conflict with the religious and thus political authorities of his time. It was love that sustained Jesus on the road to Gethsemane. And though nails fastened him to the cross physically, love kept him there until he could say with his last breath, "It is finished." And it was love that ultimately raised him from the dead. See, love is at the center of what it means to believe and hold to the gospel. It's love through which the people of God are called to fight against and conquer the spiritual forces of darkness that seek to oppress and subjugate all things that are good and all people trying to do good. And it's love, Christians believe, that will guide them home to their real and final heavenly homeland. Now, this understanding of love is the kind of love advocated by our next guest, Greg Boyd. While preaching in churches, Boyd noticed that pastors are expected to influence their congregations towards specific political choices. However, he challenged this norm and instead preached sermons that offered a biblical basis for why the church should maintain a distance from aligning too closely with any political stance, be it conservative or liberal. While this approach was largely appreciated, and led to over 20% of his congregation departing in 2004. During our conversation with Greg, we discussed how love can bring a positive change in the public sphere, impacting both faith and politics.
One priority that we have is that our job as kingdom people isn't to have the right opinions about what government should do. Our job as kingdom people is to do it. And so instead of fighting over what government should do about the neighborhood school that's dilapidated and forsaken and all that, we ask the question, what can we do to help that school? And how can we sacrifice of our time and our resources? And in doing that, you make an impact. So this happened to us maybe, I guess it was 18 years ago or so, where there's a school by us, an inner city school that was just, it was on the verge of collapse. It was always scoring the lowest on things and it had a playground that was dilapidated and dangerous. And so we could have, you know, gotten the panel together and saying, okay, let's talk about what government should do. And we probably would have had three people saying, well, they need more money, and other people saying, no, what they need is this. It could have divided. And so we spent our time arguing about something that we're not called to do and not doing the thing that we are called to do. So instead of that, let's say, how can we bleed for these people? And I think the kingdom always begins with our first drop of blood, because the kingdom always reflects Calvary kind of love. And so how can we sacrifice? Opinions are a dime a dozen, and it doesn't cost you anything. They just make you feel righteous. But what are you doing? You see, that's what's – and so, you know, John defines love as his love is this, that Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. So also we should lay down our life for one another. Mm. What good does it do if you have plenty and your neighbor is in want and you don't share? And so it's about what do you do with this? How do we live it out? So that's the first priority. And second thing – I think it's absolutely essential is that we remember that everything we do has got to be done in love. 1 Corinthians 16:14. Let everything you do be done in love, including discussing politics. And so our maxim at Woodland Hills is that God's more interested in how we discuss issues than he is on the outcome of the issues. Because as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, you can have all the gifts in the world, can have all knowledge and have all faith, you can move mountains and have all the right political opinions, but if it's not done out of love for the purpose of furthering love, it's altogether worthless. So those two. So I think in the kingdom, we should be able to have discussions on this. But do it in love. And in doing it in love, we could model to the world something that the world does not have.
Now, listeners of Faithful Politics might recall my oldest son's brave battle with a brain tumor at 9 years old. During that time, my Christian faith was deeply tested. Prayer alone couldn't ease my fears. Instead, I clung to hope for strength. This hope was essential for me to maintain my focus and sanity, and especially important now as we discuss Christian nationalism in our national discourse. This brings us to a critical point in our conversation about hope and its role in society. You see, over the past 25 years, there's been a significant shift, with 40 million Americans stepping away from the church. This exodus reflects a loss of hope and religious institutions, traditionally the bastions of comfort and solace in a challenging world. The reasons are multifaceted, encompassing cultural shifts, the hectic pace of modern life, generational differences, and unfortunately, various scandals. This decline isn't just a concern for those within the church or those opposing Christian nationalism. It impacts everyone. The rise of Christian nationalism, advocating a society where Christianity is dominant, poses a threat to religious pluralism. It risks marginalizing not just atheists, but also other faith communities, such as Muslims, Jews, and other religious beliefs in America. Understanding Christian nationalism's societal impact is crucial, and no one probably understands this more than the journalist Tim Alberta. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic and author of the book, The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory, American Evangelicals in the Age of Extremism. Tim has traveled all around the country, hearing from Americans about various faith ideologies. And here he is explaining how people of faith shouldn't necessarily be painted with the same brush as those who espouse extreme views. Let's hear what he has to say.
You know, I would say a couple of things. The first being that what breaks my heart, and a big part of the reason that I wanted to write this book, is that I think the non-believing world has judged the church, understandably so, based on its worst attributes, based on its, you know, ugliest behaviors and its, you know, and that's hard. I think it's hard when you think about kind of sweeping characterizations of any movement, any institution, but it's especially hard when it comes to the church because, as John Dixon, the Australian theologian who teaches at Wheaton College, he writes in one of his books about how Christ wrote this perfect symphony, like the most beautiful symphony the world has ever heard. Every note flawless, just perfect, and you don't even know how to process it. It's so beautiful. And then a bunch of us Joes on the street pick up our tubas and our, you know, trombones and our, and we try to play it and it sounds terrible. And people listening say, well, that symphony is terrible. You know, that symphony stinks. And you're like, well, no, hold on. It's just that I'm not any good at playing it. Right. Don't judge the symphony. Judge me. And I think, making that distinction between those of us who are not always musically gifted versus the conductor and versus the symphony is really important. And so what I've tried to do with the book and what I see a lot of people in my generation doing, and this will be my second point in a moment, but trying to make that distinction and trying to present to the outside world, like, look, ultimately, this book is trying to shine a light into the darkness, right? And when you shine a light into darkness, it exposes what is wrong and what is false. And that can be very unpleasant. But it also illuminates what is right and what is true. You know, C.S. Lewis said that we know what a crooked line looks like only because we know what a straight line looks like. And I think exposing on the one hand, but also illuminating, is just really important. And that's the work that I see a lot of Christians recommitting themselves to, because whatever's gone wrong in the church, they recognize that ultimately the best thing for the church is the same thing that's the best thing for the broader culture, which is Jesus, right? And so how do we turn the emphasis back to Jesus? How do we focus on the symphony and not on the people trying to play it?
In today's world, especially with the rising tide of Christian nationalism, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and to see the future as daunting and dark. Here's Tim again to talk about one of the things that has given him hope during his long career of covering religion and what he's experienced talking to other Christians about the rise of extremism in the faith community.
The great source of hope for me in this project has been young people. Because I'll tell you, I refer to them at one point in the book as the children of the moral majority. And I would kind of consider myself in that camp. You know, my parents, that was their generation. And the children of the moral majority, we process this stuff a lot, just in a very different way. For example, I think where so many of the threats were externalized to the moral majority, right? The government is coming for us and they're going to shut down our churches. It's the secularists. It's, you know, it's all from the outside, this threat. I think many younger Christians, when they think about the threat posed to Christianity, they start inside the church. It is an internalized conversation. It is, how did we get this so wrong? How do we clean it up? How can we better witness to our neighbors, right? And one of the places I saw that most readily was at Liberty University, where in some ways Liberty has become like a poster child of the corruption of the evangelical movement, right? And yet, within that, you've got tens of thousands of young people on that campus, young conservative evangelical Christians who they want nothing to do with the Trump movement. They want nothing to do with the MAGA movement. They don't find their identity in American politics. And that is a significant generational break from where their parents have been. And the thing that I really notice about them, these young people, when they talk to their parents about it, they're not judgmental. They're not mean-spirited. They're not condescending. They're loving. They're trying to bring back these folks who have maybe lost the plot a little bit, who have maybe gotten their priorities a little bit mixed up. I think this next generation of evangelicals, they have their eyes wide open and they can see this for what it is. And that gives me tremendous hope.
As Christians, we're taught that the church is the body of Christ. And much like any organism, is susceptible to diseases and foreign bodies that can disrupt its natural state of health. Christian nationalism certainly is one type of foreign body that can prevent the proper functioning of the church. This disease doesn't strike suddenly or visibly. It's more insidious, seeping into the church's bloodstream quietly, masking itself as familiar, even friendly. Having a clear diagnosis of the issue is the first step in understanding the possible treatments. And that's precisely what Curtis Chang is doing, along with David French and Russell Moore with the After Party. It's a course designed for faith leaders to confront toxic polarization and help heal our broken politics. Here's Curtis Chang to diagnose our politics within the modern day church.
I think the disease metaphor, and it's a metaphor, but you know, I think the disease metaphor is actually quite apt in this case, because with so many of diseases that get truly catastrophic, it's not one thing. There are often underlying conditions. You know, you had high blood pressure, you had, you were overweight, like this is, and then there's a triggering event or a triggering acute event that like then suddenly it becomes a cascading set of interlocking dynamics that really is what causes, you know, truly catastrophic diseases. And I think that's actually a good framework to think about what has happened to, again, at least the broadly speaking, in using the as the broadest term as possible, the broad American evangelical church, that you had deep underlying conditions that were part as part of it. And I would list as some of these deep underlying conditions is you had a really misshapen way of thinking of how Christians ought to relate to the rest of the world, that it was conditioned on fear, conditioned on a sense of persecution, a sense of they're out to get us. And so that was already there. That's been there for decades. That's been a, if you will, a virus that's been circulating in the evangelical DNA for decades. You had also a business model in the evangelical world that it was based on scale and mass, that you needed to build a big market, build brand recognition, build big churches so that you have a lot of giving units in your church that can support a big staff size. Like that's been the evangelical model. And the people we uphold in our popular evangelical culture are the people who've succeeded in that model, built big mega churches. This is why, Josh, I really appreciate your church model that is trying to steer away from that, because I think there's a lot of dangers in our standard evangelical business model that then causes basically the leaders, it tempts them greatly to think, what do I need to give to the masses so that I can build a big church, right? So you become a shepherd that doesn't lead your sheep, but rather is taking your cues from the sheep on how to actually get them.
As I listened to Curtis Chang, I couldn't help but be reminded of a poignant conversation I once had with the late Congressman Donald McEachin. This conversation left an indelible mark on me, especially in the context of the behavior of Congress members and their profound influence in the societal fabric of America. I remember voicing a concern to Congressman McEachin, troubled by the thought that political leaders might be unwittingly fostering unhealthy societal patterns. However, the congressman offered an insightful perspective that completely shifted my understanding. He suggested, and I'm paraphrasing, that it's not solely the politicians who define behavioral norms, but rather the voters themselves. He believed that politicians are, in many ways, reflections of the attitudes and expectations of their electorate. This revelation was a light bulb for me. It highlighted that the connection between politicians and their constituents isn't just a one-way street of influence, but a dynamic, two-way conversation. And in our representative democracy, this reciprocal influence is essential. We elect representatives to voice our concerns, and their continued power hinges on their ability to fulfill these expectations. Sadly, this idea of reciprocal influence is not just confined to the political realm. Curtis Chang's discussion about the role of church leaders reveals a parallel dynamic in the religious sphere. Commonly, we think of spiritual leaders as the primary influencers, shaping the beliefs and behaviors of their congregations. However, Chang illuminates that often these leaders are influenced by the very people they guide, adapting to their congregations, preferences, and beliefs. This observation leads us to an intriguing question. In this cycle of continuous adaptation, what does true spiritual leadership entail? How much are church leaders actually leading in the traditional sense, and how much are they reflecting their congregation's values and beliefs? And crucially, how does this dynamic align or conflict with their theological principles?
As we draw to the close of this series, it's our hope that we were able to present the profound importance of understanding Christian nationalism in America. Whether we're believers or non-believers, recognizing the impact of this ideology on our national discourse is crucial. Christian nationalism isn't just a religious or political stance. It's a lens through which many view our nation's identity, policies, and direction.
In grappling with this complex issue, it's vital to remember our shared humanity and common goals. As a nation, we can't afford to let partisanship blind us to the issues that affect us all. Sure, we'll disagree on some core principles that are important for us and our tribe, But we must not let our political differences overshadow the values that unite us. Values like compassion, justice, and a commitment to the greater good.
In the face of division, it is our faith, our shared beliefs, or even our shared hopes for a better future that can bring us together. It's about elevating our discourse and transcending our differences to find common ground and a higher purpose.
This is the essence of what we strive for in Faithful Politics. Pastor Josh and I may come from different political backgrounds, but it's our faith that unites us. And it's a reminder that despite our varied viewpoints, there's a higher call that binds us, a call to understand, empathize, and work together for a nation that reflects our highest ideals. There's one such church leader that's doing this extremely well. His name is Chuck Mingo, pastor of Crossroads Church in Cincinnati, Ohio, and founder of Undivided, which is a nonprofit catalyzing communities into action for solidarity and justice.
I think the beauty of that for me is recognizing that God is a God of unity within diversity, that God is a God that actually celebrates when followers of Jesus are able to not be divided by difference, but can be united despite difference. And I think about you and Will, right? The podcast is so rich in content and context because you're very clear that you come from very different political perspectives. What holds you together is this man called Jesus, this God man called Jesus who came, lived, and died, right? This man, this God man called Jesus who actually empowers us with the power of the Holy Spirit to love one another. And that being the underlying ethic, you can be in relationship with Christians that have a varying points of view on a lot of different things. And so I feel called to be one who, while I honor the Black church experience I came from, and that's a home base for me, I feel called to be in these spaces because I do believe that this witness is one the world desperately needs to see.
So as we reflect on the role of Christian nationalism and its impact, let us not be drawn into the divisiveness it can breed. Instead, let's commit to a dialogue that seeks understanding, that respects diversity, and that finds strength in our shared humanity. Our aim should always be to elevate our conversation, to look upwards, and to find in our faith, whether it's in a higher power or in the principles we hold dear, the guidance to navigate these challenging waters. Our country's strength lies in its ability to embrace diverse perspectives while forging a path forward for the common good. And that is what we at Faithful Politics are committed to doing. Not right, not left, but up. Because in the end, what unites us is our humanity, and our shared journey is far more powerful than what divides us in our politics. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
You see, the thing here's the trouble is that when you associate Christ with a particular political position, then all the people who hate that political position, you've now just given them reason to hate Christ. And there's a lot of people out there who are just disgusted. I know some of them just disgusted with evangelical Christianity because of its political alliances. All of their animosity towards Trump is now directed towards Christians.
Okay, so a big part of preaching is get off your pulpit, get down and be among the people and be with them and open the space for God to work and speak and be present. To pull people out of their own, like, entanglements and antagonisms and into the very presence of Christ and what he wants to do for your life.
Love has never been a popular movement, and no one's ever wanted really to be free. The world is held together, really it is held together, by the love and the passion of very few people.
So what I would hope is that Baldwin inspires people to lean hard into big questions and to love big, even when it's hard, which it certainly feels like now.
Thank you both, Will and Josh. And again, you guys are a rare air, and I thank you for what you do.
I'm really glad that you do it. I'm sure it's hard sometimes, like any job, but it's not even your core jobs, is it? I mean, this is a side gig for you guys. So audience member, support Faithful Politics. This is a light in the darkness.
If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing to our regular podcast, Faithful Politics, where a Democrat and a conservative pastor talk with authors, scholars, politicians, and journalists about topics related to faith, politics, and the intersection of the two. To learn more, please visit www.faithfulpolitics.us.